The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Bombas, the best socks in the history of feet. Get 20% off your first order. Go to bombas.com/gym. That's bombas.com/gym. Thanks, Bombas. Also, the Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. 5,000 years of wisdom on demand. Get your first month for only 99 cents. Visit Gaia.com/gym. That's Gaia.com/gym to see what's happening on the largest consciousness media streaming platform in the world. Thanks, Gaia.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you today. And I hope that you're doing well and you're having a great spring. I know the birds are chirping here and everything is starting to bloom. So it's a very exciting time of year, very reinvigorating. And I think that we have a very invigorating show for you today. We've got Lloyd Auerbach. He's going to talk about his new book, Psychic Dreaming, Dream Working, Reincarnation, Out-of-Body Experience, and Clairvoyance. And then followed up by Sky Alexander. And she's going to talk about The Modern Guide to Witchcraft, Your Complete Guide to Witches, Covens, and Spells. And maybe she will dispel some of the stereotypes out there about witches. Always fascinating to talk to people who pursue that way of life. Not my way of life, certainly, but we like to bring a lot of different experiences and a lot of different perspectives and benefit from that to being exposed to maybe some different points of view than kind of the norm. And we are so glad that you are listening to the show. I will say this. If you like the show, you like what we do, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen. That is so, so important. I can't stress it enough. If you do one thing for us, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen, iTunes, the Apple Podcasts app on your iPhone or your iPad, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you can subscribe so you get the show automatically, you rate and review. That really does help us. So please help us out. And now we start off with the one, the only, one of the smartest people in this business, Lloyd Auerbach. And here he is. Our guest today is probably what I would be to consider one of the foremost experts on the paranormal, parapsychology. Really one of the people I look up to in this area. And one of the people, when he says something, pay attention, folks, because he knows his stuff from long years of personal research. And how can I say it? He knows his stuff. We're talking about Lloyd Auerbach. He is the director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations and president since 2013 of the Forever Family Foundation, an organization supporting research on life after death and the work of spirit mediums in the grieving process. He was appointed to the faculty of Atlantic University of Virginia Beach, Virginia, in late 2010, where he teaches an online parapsychology course. He is the co-author with the late renowned psychic Annette Martin of The Ghost Detective's Guide to Haunted San Francisco. He's written many other books. He's been researching this material for decades and decades, and again, probably knows more about anybody living about these subjects. And his latest book is a reimagining of a previous book, I believe. It's called Psychic Dreaming, Dream Working, Reincarnation, Out-of-Body Experiences, and Clairvoyance. Our guest today is Lloyd Auerbach. Thank you for joining us once again, Lloyd.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be here.
So let's talk about this book, Psychic Dreaming. Now, am I correct? This is a reimagining of a previous book?
That is correct, yeah. The original Psychic Dreaming came out in 1991, and it's been long out of print. Barnes & Noble reprinted it only with a very limited press run in 1999. It sold out immediately, and for whatever reason, they didn't reprint it, but thankfully Llewellyn Worldwide has taken that one and one of my other books up, and we did kind of revise, reimagine it, play with it quite a bit. I didn't do a huge amount of updating on the dream side, but it's certainly kind of a standard text now in some respects for some people.
So when we talk about psychic dreaming, what do you mean by psychic dreaming?
Well, people have psychic experiences of all sorts. For the most part, most of our psychic experiences that happen tend to be the information type, the ESP type. And in dreams, in our dream states, we are without inhibitions, which I guess you could say that our beliefs and our normal inhibitions and society's rules get in the way while we're awake to even notice sometimes that we're having a psychic experience, and certainly to sometimes even have them. Whereas in the dream state, all bets are off, and it's a fertile ground for mainly, actually, interestingly enough, mostly precognitive experience, but also telepathic dreaming, so connecting with someone else's mind, having out-of-body experiences, possibly picking up on past lives, and certainly even real-time kind of remote viewing type dreams.
So the average person may not think of themselves as psychic. First of all, is everybody psychic to some degree, and does this apply to them, or is this just for people with special gifts?
Well, it certainly doesn't apply to just people with special gifts. Everybody has some degree of psychic ability, or at least an aptitude for it. You know, the thing is that we all have an aptitude for some form of creativity, but we don't always take advantage of it, and we don't even always notice it, or we're educated not to have it, to kind of ignore it. And that's what happens with psychic ability. As we, especially in our society, as we are kids, we're told in general, both at school and often at home in our family, that psychic stuff is not real, or it's weird, or it's strange. And so kids tend to get educated out of being psychic. Some people, of course, keep it up, just like some people keep up with their form of creativity, music and art and such. But it's really unfortunate because we do have this, I will say it's not a reliable source, but we do have a source of information that we could access that we just simply don't.
Now, when you look at being psychic, here's one of the tough things for me, and I think it is for a lot of people when you think about the subject of dreams. You know, the old saw, a bit of undigested gruel, and you just think, well, it's kind of the mental junk at the end of the day. Now, do you believe that all dreaming is psychic in its nature? Do you believe that some of it is this mental junk? Do you think it's a mixture? And how do we tell one from the other? I think that's the tough part.
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, you know, I've met people who said that they don't dream, which is actually not true. They may not remember their dreams, but what neurology, you know, neuroscience tells us and has told us for a long time is that everybody dreams. And in fact, if you don't dream, especially with sleep deprivation, you could have a psychotic break. So dreaming is good for us. Most dreams are not psychic in nature. Most dreams do not have you pulling information from the outside. Most dreams are based on whether it's day residue, deep-seated issues, fantasy. There's all sorts of things that are going through. But every so often, people do wake up remembering a dream, and especially those people who keep dream journals are able to track these, where the dream felt different. And, you know, I interviewed a lot of people when I wrote the book a long time ago and have interviewed and talked to people since then. And the really interesting thing about anybody who reports a dream that came true, for example, the precognitive dream, is did they know at the time, I asked them, did you know at the time you had the dream that this was a precognitive dream or something different? And without fail, they said, you know, I may not have known it was precognitive, but the dream felt different, or it seemed different, or it seemed realer than real. So there was something about the quality and the context of the dream that made them take notice of it, which is very different than most other dreams that people have.
That's something else. Now, you talk about different kinds of dreams. Is there a way to have more of these meaningful dreams? In other words, let's say that the percentage is 90, 10, and 10%, and I don't know that that's a percentage. But let's say 10%. Are the ones that are these meaningful dreams. Is there a way to manipulate that ratio at all?
Well, if you mean meaningful dreams as in psychic, or do you mean meaningful dreams just as having some lesson, meaning, or something
to tell
you?
Well, let's say for the sake of our discussion today, psychic.
Okay. first of all, the most important thing for people to learn, and this is something that is in the book, I have some very simple things to do to learn to work with your dreams and to remember your dreams. And one of the more interesting things that happened to me when I was writing the book, because I wasn't, and still now today I'm not, someone who always remembers his dreams. But during the writing of that book, I remembered a ton of dreams every single day. I'd wake up with a lot of stuff. And that was because my intention was set that I would remember my dreams. I mean, writing a book on dreams, you want to remember your dreams so you can really kind of attack that and possibly have psychic dreams too. So part of it is setting an intention. Part of it is actually kind of programming yourself, which, by the way, is where the idea of let me sleep on it comes from.
Right.
For decisions. That's dream incubation. People used to, even in ancient Egypt, if they had a decision to make or a process to something to work out, they would tell themselves before they go to sleep, I want to dream about this situation. I want to find out what the actual answer is. I want to come up with a real response here. And they would remember their dreams that they had or the dream that related to that because they set the intention and practiced this. And part of it also is when you wake up, we all know this, we wake up, we remember our dreams for about 30 seconds.
Exactly.
And then they're gone. Yeah, so most dream workers keep either a journal
right. Or
they have a recorder. You know, you got a smartphone now. It's got a recorder on it. When you wake up, you can always talk into that. And that reinforces the idea of remembering your dreams. Once you get into this process of remembering your dreams, you can actually program yourself to try to have more psychic dreams of different sorts. It doesn't always work because, you know, psychic ability is not as controllable as we'd like it to be. And the future is kind of always in motion, as Yoda would say. So we may not be able to always get the right future. That's the one interesting thing about precognition is you're not always picking up on the right future, but you're going to pick up a lot of information that way.
Now, not all psychic dreams, I guess, are created equal. Are there different categories of psychic dreams?
Yeah, just like there's different categories of psychic experiences in general. So you might have shared dreaming, which is, or telepathic or mutual dreaming, where you and a spouse or you and a good friend have exactly the same dream. This has happened to me with friends over the years, and I know a number of other people have had that same kind of shared experience. You might have a dream, you know, one of the things about dreams of the future, which are difficult, is the timing issue. So let's say that in the middle of the night, at some point in the night, you had a dream about something that happens, a disaster, a car accident, a robbery. Usually it tends to be negative because that's more emotional for people, but it also could be something very positive too. And you wake up in the morning and you turn on the TV and lo and behold, there's the story. Now, you had no idea that was going to happen. So the question then is, did you dream about the incident when it happened, or did you dream about you watching the news and getting the feedback? So it's a really tough issue, and this is something with precognition in general. We're not quite sure whether, in fact, people often who do have an experience while they're awake of something about to happen may actually not be picking up on the event. They may be picking up on the news of the event that they're going to see to confirm that they actually had a correct prediction.
Now, other things that you talk about in this book, lucid dreams. Now, this is interesting. I don't have it often, but it is an odd feeling to be in a dream and say, hey, I know I'm dreaming. Talk about that a little bit and where that comes into play.
Well, you know, that's a part of the book is really giving people a background on dreams and sleep and dreaming in general, because there's a lot of myths around that, and a lot of people have not kind of been exposed to some of the basic knowledge we have about dreams. And most people don't even know there's a controversy in neuroscience as to whether it's a good idea to remember your dreams. There are some folks, including Francis Crick, who was one of the discoverers of DNA, who have said that it is the garbage at the end of the day, and there's no reason, in fact, you should not remember your dreams, you should not work with your dreams. And yet there's this whole school of thought all over the world that remembering your dreams and working with them is a good thing. And frankly, the practice shows that. So I have to kind of lean in that direction, certainly. Lucid dreaming is that state in which you have a dream, and in the dream state, you are aware that you are dreaming. And in that state, people can actually control their dreams. People can, you know, now it's your reality base. It's whatever you want it to be. Stephen LaBerge wrote the classic book on lucid dreaming back in the late 70s, and he's at Stanford University. Even though lucid dreaming was first named and described and discovered by a parapsychologist in the early 20th century, Trevor Von Eden, psychology just ignored it completely. In fact, they ignored it again in the 60s when Celia Green, another parapsychologist, wrote a book on lucid dreaming. It took somebody involved in neuroscience to finesse how it was described, not somebody from parapsychology for mainstream science to even take notice of it. People can learn it through lucid dream. It's not an easy process, but there are methods. One method I talk about in the book from LaBerge, actually, and he's a great person to look at for this, is when you're dreaming, you know, get yourself in the habit when you're doing your dream incubation, when you're thinking about having a dream when you're going to sleep, to tell yourself you're going to wake up in the dream. And that might actually kind of program yourself to do that. While you're in that lucid state, you can have a psychic experience. I mean, just like you can control reality, say, okay, now I want to be a psychic. And you can try to pick up on specific things, like a remote viewer would, for example.
And that's amazing to me, just how it works. That's why it seems to me, and the other thing you talked about, sleeping on it. That's amazing to me, because I don't know how many times, whether it was when I was in school or just through life, you have a difficult problem and you're beating your head against the wall and you said, you know, I'm just going to let it go. I'm going to go to sleep on it. I'm going to go to bed. And then the next day, all of a sudden, the answer just appears out of nowhere. And your mind was working on this problem overnight, possibly. And it's just amazing how there's this whole other world we're not aware of.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that you might have even had a dream in which you played out all the scenarios.
But forgot.
To see which one. But forgot, yeah, but seemed to, you know, work out. And people do that. People program, you know, they want to ask their boss for a raise, but they're not sure how to do it. So they'll program themselves to have that dream, and they get to kind of role play in the dream state.
Yeah, that's very neat. Another thing, and I'm fascinated by this topic in general, but as it relates to dreams, reincarnation in dreams. You covered that as well.
Covered it a little bit, yeah. You know, people who spontaneously recall past lives have often reported having had dreams of that past life. For the most part, in parapsychology, we do our research in reincarnation with children. So we're not dealing with dreams at that point. We're dealing with kids usually between 3 and 5 or 6 years old, and mostly between around three and four years old, because they haven't been contaminated by a lifelong exposure to all sorts of other information sources. But on occasion, you know, people do have these really dramatic and sometimes very evocative and specific dreams that seem, you know, this kind of provide enough information that maybe this is a real reincarnation-related situation, as opposed to hypnosis, where you have quite a bit of suggestion going on, and it's unclear as to what's happening, whether it's reincarnation or not.
I'm curious about dreams of warning. I think of President Lincoln, and apparently, I don't know if it's true or not, but I've always heard that he had a dream where he saw a casket, and he asked one of the mourners, who's in the casket? And I said, the president is dead. Dreams of warning. I'm sure you've covered those as well.
Yeah. And in fact, I talk about the Lincoln experience. That is a true experience. That was, I believe, a couple of weeks before he was assassinated. People do have these precognitive dreams warning them of negative events. There's actually a number of interesting experiences that people had written to me that I put in the book as well. And you can change these things. You know, if you have, especially, this is the thing we know about precognition, is if you have enough information, you tend to be able to change things if you're willing to take that chance. You can't change whether an earthquake happens, but you can change whether you're going to be there when the earthquake happens. And in situations where people are warned of a car accident or warned of something that's going to happen to them or to a loved one, they can very often, you know, certainly make a different decision, make a different choice. The problem, and this has happened, I get calls or emails from people, and I've gotten letters from people over the years where they've had multiple precognitive experiences about someone they knew dying or getting really seriously injured. And at some level, they're having a real issue. And their issue is they've tried to warn these people, and of course they get rebuffed, and then the thing happens anyway. And they don't know if they've caused it or if they should even tell people. I have people asking me, should I tell them that this is what I got, this is my dream? And you have to be very careful because some people get very bent out of shape if you're going to tell them to do something or not to do something based on a dream, especially for that. So it can be very difficult. And there are some people that have them throughout their lives on specific events, such as a relative or someone's going to die, and of natural causes, not even necessarily of from accidents or anything right. like that. And on occasion, those people get to a point where they think they're causing it.
Oh my!
They wonder if they're. Yeah, and there's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that. This is all about precognition. And we think the warnings are to prepare us for the death of those people, to help us with our kind of our pre-grieving, you might say, not necessarily to try to prevent it, because if it's natural causes, you can't really prevent it.
It's interesting because I remember this is not really precognition, but after the death of my grandfather, my mom, who has since passed as well, but this is when I was a little kid, like 10 years old, she recounted having had one of the most vibrant dreams she'd ever had. And she saw my late grandfather walking across the street, and he looked directly at her. And she said it was as real as if I could go out and touch him. And I wonder if dreams like that are the dead trying to communicate with us.
Yeah, those visitation dreams are pretty interesting. I had one after my grandfather died with him. And, you know, there is that context and quality, I think, that these psychic dreams absolutely feel different. In my experience, my dream with my grandfather, it felt different than any dream I had ever had before. So I was pretty sure it was not my mind. I wouldn't say playing tricks on me. You know, one of the questions that we have is whether that visitation is actually your unconscious trying to help you through the grief by having that contact. But then there's that quality of that dream that matches the other kinds of psychic dreams as well, which would indicate that it's something more.
Telepathy. Now, this is something that I've not had the experience of. I don't know if it's less common or not, but telepathy in dreams.
Yeah, that's the shared dreaming idea. It's the idea that people sometimes have the same dream, the same night, often the same time. And there are many, many, many experiences on record of that. Mutual dreaming, you can call it. It often usually happens with people you're close to emotionally or related to, but more often to people you're close to.
It's interesting because on our campfire show, we had a woman on, and she talked about having a shared dream, I think, with her boyfriend or fiance, and it was exactly the same dream. And that was amazing to me, what the mechanism of that kind of thing was. Now, I mean, are there certain tips and tricks to putting yourself in a good mental state to dream well? I mean, I'm assuming a comfortable bed, obviously dream journals are good ideas. What are some of the tips and tricks to make the most of our dreaming ability?
It really is keeping track of them. And also, interestingly enough, talking about them with people. There are dream groups all over the United States, actually all over the world. Montague Ullman, who was a parapsychologist and a psychiatrist, kind of pioneered, or I should say brought in a Swedish technique for doing dream work many, many years ago to the United States. And it's partly about discussing your dreams with other people. Gail Delaney, who's a dream expert, sleep and dreaming expert here in the San Francisco area, actually wrote in her books, and her books are, I highly recommend her books. She wrote the idea, you know, we have these books that are out there called dream interpretation books. You know, you have all the dream symbols and stuff.
Right.
You could pick up a dream dictionary anywhere. Don't do that. Those are worthless. They pretty much are worthless. They are either copying each other or they are pulling from the imagery and metaphors and symbolism of the author, which is not your mind. It's someone else's mind. And the reality is what G- Gail Delaney pointed out is that if you look at your dream, and this is really very, very similar to the way we would do research with remote viewing, doing a remote viewing experiment, which is to just jot down all the imagery, not try to name it, not try to make any sense of it until you get everything down, and then look at all the things that are in it and ask yourself, okay, if I was a Martian, what would I think of this object? You know, would I think it was a banana or some sort of yellow piece of PVC that had some other function? So to really kind of take it apart as if you're someone else who doesn't even know what the symbols are. We tend to immediately name things or categorize things when, in fact, dreams might provide us with partial images, just like remote viewing sessions do, and we may need to actually piece it together. On the other hand, having that discussion with other people, asking you questions, you know, the main question is, what do you think it meant? So when people ask me, well, I had this dream about such and such, what do you think it meant? They say that to me, and I say, what do you think it meant?
Yeah, because it would seem
it's
to be
not
so
about what I think it
meant. Yeah, so individual. You know, it would seem so individual.
Totally.
You don't have the frame of reference that person. You don't have the life experiences. So to me, and we've had people on with dream dictionaries and those kind of things because we talk to a lot of different people. But to me, it almost seems like when you read the horoscope in the newspaper, even if you believe in astrology, it's too broad based. You know, it's not honed down enough.
Well, of course, I mean, the newspaper horoscopes, you could read some other sun sign. It would still apply to you.
Right. You may be feeling a bit down today. Well, that's about half the population on any given day or more.
That's right. Especially right now.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think last week was the most depressing day of the year, they said, or something. So psychic dreaming. Do you think, and we've had this discussion before, you know, you have the materialistic sciences and scientists who just feel, you know, everything is just very materialistic. And while certainly I believe that that's part of dreaming, to me, it just seems like there's something more, and you've kind of nailed down what that something more is. Do you see them coming your way?
What's interesting is that there are materialists in parapsychology who do not believe that consciousness is anything but the brain, who absolutely have no problem with, and in fact support, looking at the idea that our minds, our brains, can pull information from other sources, even from the future. And so it's, you know, the materialist viewpoint is not a problem. They have no problem with psychic dreams if they have no problem with psychic ability. It's when they have a problem with psychic ability, then they're going to, you know, start trashing the concept to some extent.
So the question is, the very important question, where can people find this book? Because I think if you're into this kind of material, and you're into dreaming, you've not run into Lloyd's previous book. And if you've run into it, you're going to run into this one too, because it's updated. But I think you should get this book. So Lloyd, where can we get this book?
Well, it will be available at bookstores everywhere and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble's site the very beginning of April. It's coming soon.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. Our guest has been Lloyd Auerbach, one of our favorite guests because, you know, in this area, there's so much room for kind of, well, here's what I think's going on. But Lloyd has done the research, he's done the work, and we admire what he does. Lloyd, thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
Thank you, Jim.
Always fascinating to speak with Lloyd and get another gem, another great book that he has done. And he's one of those people, along with people like Rosemary Ellen Guiley and Jeff Belanger and those types of folks, and many others I'm not mentioning, but those are some that come to mind. They really, really know their stuff. And when they say something, I definitely listen. And next up, we're going to talk with someone who knows their stuff about witchcraft, of all things. Sky Alexander joins us right after this very important message. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Bombas, the best socks in the history of feet. Yes, in the entire history of feet, that is. And you can get 20% off your first order by going to bombas.com/gym. That's bombas.com/gym. Now, this is not just about a great discount that I'm going to tell you about. It's also a great story. About 4 years ago, two guys quit their jobs at a media company to make a difference in the world with, of all things, socks. Seems pretty unique. But they had good reason. They learned that socks were the most requested items in homeless shelters, and at the same time, they realized there was a gap in the marketplace for a better crafted and more thoughtfully thought out sock. So that's what they did. They went ahead and made that better sock, and they've made several substantial improvements, which have actually made Bombas the best sock in the history of feet. And they did it with 2 years on R&D, 2 years before they made a sock. Now, their customers overwhelmingly say that they're obsessed with Bombas because they're the most comfortable socks they've ever worn. But get this, not only have they made a great sock, they've made a difference because for every pair that Bombas sells, they donate a pair to those in need. Over 2 million pairs donated so far. If you need new socks, you cannot go wrong with Bombas. Whether your superpower is moving through a spreadsheet with your eyes closed or dominating your recreational volleyball league, everyone deserves comfort, and comfort is Bombas' superpower. Now, I know you're going to love Bombas, and you're going to love the feeling knowing that you've got the best socks in the history of feet, but so does someone else who really, really needs them. So here's the offer. Exclusively 20% off your first order, money-back guarantee, free shipping on orders of $30 and more, and all you have to do is go to bombas.com/gym. That's bombas.com/gym. The promo code gym will pop up, and you'll put that in when you make your order, and there you go. And I really believe you're going to love it at bombas.com/gym. Check them out. They do have the best socks in the history of feet, and they've got the best story in the history of socks. You're going to thank yourself. Your feet are going to thank you, and then you're going to feel good too. bombas.com/gym. Thanks, Bombas. Our guest today is going to talk about a subject that I think it's fair to say is looked at in one fashion, and maybe the reality is quite different, and she's going to try to clarify that for us. We're talking about Skye Alexander, and she is the author of the book, The Modern Guide to Witchcraft, Your Complete Guide to Witches, Covens, and Spells, because we have all of those notions from popular culture, and Skye is going to kind of give us the lowdown of what really is going on. She is the award-winning author of more than 30 fiction and nonfiction books. Her stories have been published in anthologies internationally, and her work has been translated into more than a dozen languages. The Discovery Channel featured her in the TV special Secret Stonehenge, doing a ritual at Stonehenge. She divides her time between Texas and Massachusetts. Skye, welcome to the program today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Jim. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Now, the book, The Modern Guide to Witchcraft, who is it meant for?
It's meant primarily for people who are novices or who are just starting on this path. Or anyone who's just curious about learning more about witchcraft and what it really is.
Now, we know all of the stereotypes about witchcraft, you know, whether it's the Wicked Witch of the West, whether it's Samantha in Bewitched, whatever they may be. There are many of them out there. Can you talk to us a little bit about the difference between the stereotype and the reality?
Well, first of all, the stereotypes are either promoted by Hollywood, or they're promoted by what we would call more patriarchal, conventional religions that want to make witches seem scary or dangerous. And usually these are people who have not looked into it any further. So it generates fear of the unknown, or from Hollywood's perspective, more of a humorous perspective, you know, a humorous look at witchcraft, neither of which is really true. I mean, witches are people just like everybody else. The person who does your hair or fixes your car could very well be a witch. They're ordinary people living ordinary lives for the most part. The difference is that they are aware more of their power and aware of how their actions affect themselves and others.
Now, when somebody comes to you and says, well, I want to become a witch, what is the What is the exploration project or process? What do you ask them? Why do they want to become a witch? I guess the question, or what would you just say to somebody like that? And then also, I guess the question is, why become a witch?
Well, I think a lot of people today are exploring witchcraft because, and Wicca in particular. First of all, let me clarify that most people, or many people, confuse the two. And Wicca is a belief system. It's a religion that's actually recognized by the U.S. Defense Department, and it's a relatively modern religion at that. And witchcraft is a practice that can be engaged in by anyone of any belief system or no belief system of a religious nature. So I just wanted to clarify that because it is something that a lot of people confuse. But if somebody came to me and said he or she wanted to be a witch, I would possibly ask why, and then I would suggest they start reading. There is a ton of material both in book form and also online, and I would suggest they start reading a little bit about it before they proceed further. Certainly, if anyone wants to ask me questions, and people do all the time, I'm happy to answer them to the best of my ability.
So when we talk about magic, and we mean magic with the CK, and right in your book, right up front, you address this question. What is magic, and how can it help people?
How can it help you? Okay, well, magic is the practice of using your will to create consciously some change or condition in your life. And you're using your mind, you're using your emotions, you're using your imagination, not things that can necessarily be measured in a material way, but they will generate material outcomes if that's your intent. Some of the ways that witchcraft can help you, well, it can improve your love life. It can help you attract prosperity. When I say witchcraft, I should have said magic there. I'm lumping them together here. It can help you provide protection for yourself and your loved ones. It can improve your health, protect your home and your personal property. You can use it to attract or open up new career opportunities or help you advance in your career path. It can help you improve the interactions with your friends, your family, your coworkers, help you ward off problems with and enemies and keep yourself safe. Let's see. Biggest of all, I think, for many people, is that it gives you more control over your life by helping you to connect with more of the pieces of yourself, both at a higher level, a spiritual level, if you will, your higher self, to help you strengthen your intuition and your psychic skills so that you are more in touch with your environment, but also to get deeper into yourself and make that connection stronger also.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, did you want me to address the question of what the K in magic means when it's spelled that way?
Frankly, I did not think of that question. I think that's a fabulous point. Please tell us.
Well, you mentioned it, so I thought perhaps I should address it because a lot of people don't know. The K is added to set aside and clarify the type of magic we're talking about here, from stage illusion or card tricks, that sort of thing. And the English magician Aleister Crowley is usually credited with adding that K.
So when we talk about magic and witchcraft, what are the different types? I mean, is it all the same, or are there different forms that are distinguished in some way?
Well, there are various belief systems. There certainly are various practices. What are called sometimes ceremonial or ritual or high magicians often engage in very complex rituals. They draw a lot upon Egyptian magic and are involved often with tarot, astrology, alchemy, and things like that. Green witches and hedge witches are more inclined to engage in a more simple, nature-based, home-based, everyday sort of magic that may or may not include any really elaborate rituals or chants or anything like that. Wiccans, even though we often think of that as being matriarchal in nature or having more women engaged in it than men, men are certainly welcome. It's we look at both a goddess and a god as being important in balancing and keeping harmony within the universe. So then there are traditions such as Dianic Wiccans, which are more feminist-oriented or have a feminist agenda. There are lots and lots of different types of witches, and they have different practices. However, at the very core of it all is the utilization of your will in connection with the energies in the universe, in the cosmos, in order to produce a result that you desire.
Now, we often hear in pop culture about black magic. Is black magic a real thing? And what is it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, a lot of people do black magic without even knowing they're doing it, because all of us are using our minds and our emotions and our will and our imagination all the time. A knowledgeable witch will do that consciously, but the rest of us who may not know the impact and recognize the power that we have will sometimes do this accidentally. Like, say a driver cuts you off on the road and you curse him. That's a form of black magic. You may not have enough power to make anything really bad happen from it, but just as a general rule, black magic means doing something with intent to harm. White magic is doing something to improve your connection with the higher powers, divine, spirit, whatever you want to call that entity or that being or that power. And gray magic is everything else. Gray magic is what most people are doing when they do magic intentionally to create consciously a circumstance or an outcome.
Well, I got to tell you, I feel kind of guilty here because I think I've actually practiced black magic. I generally don't wish ill on people because I do believe in karma and that things will come back. You know, there's old saying you spit up in the heavens and it comes back down on you. But distinctly, I remember maybe a month ago, it was very late at night. My high school daughter was attending a cast party for her high school play, and she's a senior, and it was quite late, and it was very, very bad weather. And I was driving very cautiously, and a gentleman passed me on a two-lane road at a place where you're not supposed to pass, and very recklessly, in this very bad weather. And I remember distinctly saying to my daughter, I hope he physically comes to no harm, but I hope that he's up ahead in a ditch. Because I felt like, I don't want anybody to get hurt, but it wouldn't bother me at all if his car got torn up, because I just felt that was very dangerous and irresponsible. And I bet that there are a lot of people out there have said that kind of thing, and maybe even worse. So I guess that, you know, many of us have at one time or another practiced black magic and didn't know it.
That's true. And I think that's one of the things that is important about being aware whether you're, you know, a magician or whether you are simply a responsible individual. To be aware that your thoughts do have power, your words have power, and that you become more in tune with what you are saying, what you're doing, because I'm sure you've heard of the law of attraction. You know, that was popular.
Well, I was going to bring that up, actually, with The Secret.
Okay.
and going back to way before that, you know, a lot of work that Think and Grow Rich and those kind of things. I mean, really, when you think about it, what you're talking about, if you're putting something out in the universe with an intention, and that is magic, that to me very much sounds like Napoleon Hill or The Secret or even Norman Vincent Peale to some extent, you know, the power of positive thinking. I mean, to me, it just sounds like a different form of it.
Well, you're absolutely right. The law of attraction basically just says that what you put your mind on, you attract to you. So the idea, of course, is to put your mind on things that you want to attract, not on stuff that you don't want in your life.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. Our guest today is Skye Alexander. The book is The Modern Guide to Witchcraft, and we'll be back right after this. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. And keep listening, because I'm going to tell you how you can get your first month for only 99 cents. Now, you're listening to this show. That means that you're obviously interested in the supernatural, in the strange, the unusual, the Fortean. And you know where to come for great audio content. I hope that you feel that way about our programs. But where do you go if you want a streaming TV video service with those same values and that same type of content? And there's just one answer, and I've been telling you, and I will continue to tell you until you try it. It is Gaia, because Gaia explores these topics we love, and they're always providing viewers with tremendous new content. Now, for example, this week, no exception, if you were a member of Gaia, just a few of the new shows you could watch: Buzzsaw with Sean Stone. He talked on The Occult, Bringing Your Will to the World, or Bill Foss joined George Norrie on Beyond Belief, and they discussed Journey to the Akashic Records. And then all episodes of Linda Moulton Howe's Truth Hunter series are now posted on Gaia. There's just so much great content, and now there's a page where you can get a flavor for all of it. Now, it's a paid setup for me. I'm very flattered. Really set up for you, my listeners. It's at Gaia.com/Jim. That's GAIA.com/Jim. What I really like about that page is they have a lot of little snippets there, so you can have a little kind of supernatural smorgasbord and have a little sampling here and a little sampling there, and quickly get a sense of what you're missing by not being on Gaia. So today I was looking at that supernatural smorgasbord, and a few things I found: a video on Lessons from the 12 Angels. Another one, Revelations from a Remote Viewing from Lynn Buchanan. I believe that was a snippet off of George Norrie's show. And then another one on magnetic pole shifts and space domains. That sounds fascinating. Really, there is nothing else like Gaia. There's all those ones I mentioned and so much more. It's like a video supermarket for consciousness studies. Your one-stop shop if you're looking for streaming video on the topics that we love. So go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. And the other thing I'll point out, after you're done sampling and enjoying some of that content, go in the upper right-hand corner of that page at Gaia.com/Jim. There's a little red button that says sign up. And if you click on that, you'll have the opportunity to sign up for your first month for only 99 cents. Now, there's some other great offers there too, but if you just want to dip a toe, you can sign up for 99 cents for your first month. Gaia is great, and you're going to want to check it out. Visit Gaia.com/Jim. That's GAIA.com/Jim. To see what's happening on the largest consciousness media streaming platform in the world. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Sky Alexander. The book is The Modern Guide to Witchcraft, Your Complete Guide to Witches, Covens, and Spells. And Sky, so I will ask you about this. Again, most of us, what we, quote, know about witches comes from pop culture. And when you say covens, a very specific picture comes to mind. Where, again, in this regard, does, Hollywood deviate from reality?
Well, I think that Hollywood, again, either makes it spooky and scary or humorous when they attempt to show how witches work together. A coven traditionally has 13 members, but that is not necessarily the way it has to be. It can be as large or as small a group of people as necessary. Generally speaking, a coven is a closed circle that you are invited into to participate with people of like mind, people whose energies you feel will complement yours and yours will complement theirs, and so that you can work together harmoniously. And by blending your skills and your talents, you can do better magic. You can strengthen each other's abilities. But it also is can be a social group as well, to an extent. It can be a support group, a family for people who often are in places where they maybe feel a little bit different or ostracized even, so that the coven gives you the community that you need to find yourself and to follow your path successfully.
What is something that would surprise the average person? By average, I mean the person who is not a witch and maybe not familiar with it. What would surprise them about witches or witchcraft?
Well, I'll give you an example. I have a friend who's a very nice man, very Catholic, and when he went on my website and discovered that I was a witch, he called me and he said, "How can you be a witch? You're so nice." And I said, "Whatever gave you the idea that witches can't be nice?" I think that's one of the things that often surprises people, that we generally are not going to turn people into toads. Or somebody came up to me the other day and said, "I want to ask you, are you a witch? And you're not going to turn me into a toad for saying that, are you?" And I said, "We really don't do that, you know." That's the thing. Most people, I think, who have been conditioned by traditional religious views in a fear-based attitude, they think we're evil, they think we're mean, they think we're going to harm them, and that is probably the furthest thing from the truth.
When you're a witch, when you're calling on the universe to have a particular outcome, do you have to be careful? I'll give you an example because I'm not very familiar with witchcraft, so I probably wouldn't be able to give you a good example. But for example, when somebody uses something like a Ouija board, you know, to try to reach out to a loved one who has passed or something, there's often a concern that other spirits and things can come in, kind of the law of unintended consequences. Do you have to be careful when practicing witchcraft and magic that you don't invite something that you really don't want to play host to?
Well, I think it's a good idea. There are certainly many, many entities in the universe. Some of them are not as nice as others, and you if you're careless, I guess, allow yourself to be open to those beings that are out there. The Ouija board especially has gotten a bad rap, but it's no different really than any other tool that you might use to make a connection with whatever spirit being you're trying to communicate with. That may be a departed ancestor, it may be a loved one, it may be a higher self, an angel, a guide, or a guardian of some kind. And what I generally do, and this is just my technique, it's very easy, is just to surround myself, envision myself being surrounded by a sphere of pure white light and love and peace, and I ask that I be protected and that only good intent and good beings come through to me. And that generally is enough. I mean, other people may have more elaborate rituals that they do for protection before they do any kind of spell or do any kind of ritual. And that can be left up to the individual. Often there's a practice called casting a circle that witches will do to symbolically and spiritually and in the form of energy create a barrier around themselves when they're doing a ritual or ceremony or spell of some kind in order to both hold the positive energy in until they're ready to release it, but also to protect themselves against unwanted energies or disturbances that could interfere with the practice.
Now, in the book, you talk about sacred spaces, altars, and shrines. Tell us the role that those components play in witchcraft.
Okay, well, sacred space is where you have a place where you have filled the area with love, harmony, peace, positive intentions. It can be your home, it can be a place outdoors, it can be anywhere. You do not have to cast a circle around the space. You fill it. It's often a good thing to do, for example, when you have people coming over to your house, particularly family gatherings during the holidays where there could be tension. But it's filled with your intention to create love and harmony in the space around you. Now, altars, just as they are in churches, are places that give you a focus to do your work. And you may have a permanent altar in your home somewhere if you have the space for it. You can create an altar outside. It's like the witch's workbench, and it's where he or she will go to perhaps cast a spell or contact a deity of some sort or to practice any other form of magic or spiritual activity. You might go there to meditate or to sing or to do whatever you feel is part of your own practice. And the altar can be a central location where other witches, if you choose to work with other people, can gather to do a ritual or another form of ceremony. A shrine is something that you build as a way of honoring someone or something. It can be a person, particularly someone who's passed. You'll see them along highways, for example, where people have had accidents that were fatal. But a shrine may also be something that you dedicate to a particular god or goddess or spiritual being that you wish to honor. And they can be portable also. They can be things that you take with you when you travel, like a little box or something that you put some things in that have meaning to you so that you can take that little altar or that shrine along with you someplace else. And then it can also be something if you live in a place where you're afraid that someone might not take well to seeing your altar set up with candles and crystals and all kinds of things on it. You can just do something on a shelf, a bookshelf, that reminds you of whatever your intention is and that for you seems somewhat sacred and nobody else has to know what it is.
Another thing you talked about, this is very ironic. I'm sitting here and sometimes when I do my audio interviews, I have a couple of stones here, gemstones.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the name of them. One's kind of a golden stone. I think that was supposed to be for prosperity. And then I have a little tiny crystal skull. And sometimes when I'm doing interviews like this, when I'm listening to a very interesting answer like that one, I'll just kind of have it in my hand like a worry bead. So here I find out that that is part of witchcraft and magic. Maybe I'm more of a witch than I know, but, the question is that talk about the part of crystals and gemstones in magic.
Okay. Well, a lot of people who do magic work do use crystals of some sort or gemstones. And that's because, and we also use other things from nature. We use plants. It's basically the idea is that all organic beings, all organic substances have energy. And that energy is something that we can tap and utilize to strengthen or in some way enhance our own intention. And it also helps, as you're doing right now, helps you focus and helps you stay calm and helps you balance your own resonance within yourself while you're working. And the different stones all have different meanings and different ways that you might utilize them within a spell. For example, you're talking about your golden gem that you're holding, which might be a topaz. I don't know what it is. But often golden gemstones are used for prosperity. And the reason for that is what we might call the law of similars. When something seems similar to something else, then it triggers those associations in our minds and allows us to tap that power to make something happen for us. Okay, so the gold obviously symbolizes gold coins, gold money, the wealth that you are seeking. So gold stones are often used for prosperity spells.
And it's interesting because I do believe there's something to it because you tend to see successful people are successful and people who have a tough time tend to stay in that. Now, sometimes people can break out, but it seems like to me 9 times out of 10, I go back to the power of positive thinking. You know, if you feel that you can do so, I think it was Henry Ford who said, I believe,
yes,
said, whether you think you can do something or not, you're right.
Yes, that is from Henry Ford, obviously a very successful man. And you're right. In fact, one of the biggest obstacles to performing successful spells, successful magic, is doubt. It's like pouring water on fire. It's going to put out that vitality. And so you really have to trust the universe, trust yourself, and believe in what you want and believe in yourself that you can bring this to you. And you're right. Keep your mind focused on positive things. And whenever you catch yourself, and we all do, catch ourselves thinking about something negative. What I do is I just envision one of those, circles with the line, with the diagonal line through it that
Yeah.
Says no.
Good point. I
like that.
Cancel
that right out and replace it with a positive one.
Now, you talked about spells. Now, again, I'm going to relate back to the pop culture reference because that's what I know and probably most people listening. You picture somebody doing this incantation over a boiling pot or whatever it is. I mean, that's the picture we get in our mind, the little movie that plays. Give us kind of put that no sign through that and tell us what spells are really about and kind of how it's done.
Well, actually, you can do that. I mean, we get that picture, of course, from Shakespeare's, you know, Three Witches Over the Cauldron. But and we do get it from Hollywood, too, of course. But that's perfectly acceptable way to do a spell. In fact, a cauldron is a tool that many witches use because it symbolizes the womb. It also symbolizes holding something until it is ready to be released to come to fruition. It nurtures and holds and builds and strengthens whatever it is that you're using in your spell. You could use a spell that does have something in it that they're stirring, a libation of some sort. And you can use incantations, and in fact, incantations and affirmations are frequently parts of spells. An affirmation is just a short, positive statement of what you are intending to do. An incantation puts it to a rhyme, so it's a little easier for you to remember. It can be as short or as long as you want, and you can use an incantation pretty much in any spell you want. So part of that image is absolutely correct, but you don't have to use any tools at all. Even though magicians and witches of all kinds generally do use certain tools because they help to focus your mind, you don't really need any of them. All you have to use is the power comes from within you, not from any given tool, not from a magic wand, not from a cauldron, not from any other tool that you may use. It's just a tool.
Now, I'll throw another one out at you and see if it's a misconception. This whole idea of, you know, to make something happen, I need half of a pig snout, three leaves from an oak tree, you know, the head of a dead bat. I mean, is there any truth in something like that at all?
Yes and no. Yes, because as we were talking earlier about all gemstones and plants having a particular energy of their own that you can tap and use in combination with your own skills, your own energy, your own mental power. So yes, indeed, some of those things are very helpful and can augment what you're doing. And I often recommend using things, not necessarily, you know, eye of newt or tongue of frog, not that kind of thing, but certainly using gemstones, using herbs of various kinds, flowers, water, candles, lots of different things in spells. But you don't have to. That's the main thing that is perhaps a misconception. And ask I think there was a second part of your question, and I don't remember what it was.
No, I think that was basically it. Is this rooted in some reality? I mean,
yes, it is, but you don't need that. And that's the one thing I want to remind people. It's just, does it help you to get your mind and your feelings more engaged in the ritual, the spell, or whatever practice you're engaging in? That's the main reason for using tools, particularly things like candles. You can gaze at a candle, and it helps to move you from the mundane to the magical realm because you feel, you know, your mind is a little bit calmer or your vision is a little bit softer, and you might be able to see things and sense things that you don't otherwise. So candles are often used in spells, probably the most often used tool.
Now, would people be surprised of how many witches are really out there who maybe just don't let it known to the general public? I mean, is there a large underground witch community, so to speak?
Sure. It depends on where you live. If you live in Salem, Massachusetts, or San Francisco, or someplace like that, Glastonbury, England, you can be as open as you want. Nobody's going to bother you. If you live in a little conservative Christian rural community like I live in Texas, you have to be a little bit more careful, a little bit quieter about what you do. But yes, there is probably a very large underground. We're not quite sure how many witches there are, of course, but according to religion facts, between about 1 and 3 million people worldwide consider themselves to be Wiccans. Now, that's not all of the different branches of witchcraft. That's just Wicca. So there probably are a whole lot more than you realize, because most of us don't have pointy hats or big noses with warts on them, or we don't ride around on broomsticks and things like that.
When we talk about magic, there's this, and I'm going to keep pointing back to the stereotypes. The ideas that, you know, a witch, I think of something like Bell Book and Candle, or even Bewitched, where a witch can literally make something levitate or something like supernatural, in fact. But it seems like to me, from everything I've gathered, is that it's much more subtle than that. And you're not talking about these, you know, levitation. For example, you're talking about subtle energies. Is that the right idea?
For the most part, there are a few people, of course, who can do more dramatic things. Most people don't. Most people may not have the ability. I've certainly never levitated anything that I know of. And for the most part, that's not really what the whole point is. The whole point is to use your energy, your power, your intention to make things better for yourself and other people and other beings in the world and in the universe. So, you know, parlor tricks aren't particularly high on our list of priorities.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. Our guest has been Sky Alexander. We've been talking about The Modern Guide to Witchcraft. Sky, where can people find the book, and where can they find more information about everything you do?
Well, certainly anybody who wants to can look at my website, which is www.skyalexander.com. And you can, if you want, purchase the book through my website. You can go to your local, if you have a New Age store, you might be more lucky at finding books on witchcraft, including my own, than you would at, let's say, a big superstore. But you can always find them online. Amazon is, you know, an easy source, but so are lots of other online sites that carry not only my books, but other books that are on the subject that might be interesting to people.
Well, Sky, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about The Modern Guide to Witchcraft.
And thank you so much for having me on, Jim. I've enjoyed it.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that show as much as we did, packed with a lot of information. We try to do that every week, and I think this time we hit the mark. And I hope that you'll rate, review, and subscribe to the shows, because that's how people learn about us. We don't have those big marketing budgets. It's me and a very small team of folks to put these shows together, and we're not a big conglomerate with big investment capital and venture capital, and we have 27 different podcasts and, you know, 20 people working on one podcast, which is becoming more and more the norm these days. It's just me and a very, very small team. Typically, these shows will be handled by two people, me and my associate producer, Maddie. Sometimes we'll bring in a third person, an editor, although I edited this show. So that kind of tells you you're dealing with a small operation here. Small but mighty, I like to say, and even more powerful if you help us out by rate, reviewing, and subscribing. We thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.